So how do we fix the world? So it's a nice small subject for us to consider this evening, isn't it? How do we fix the world? If you type that into Google, there are plenty of hits, lots of suggestions around about what we might do, but not all of them seem to really have grasped the issue. So on page one of Google Hits, we get theatlantic.com, which suggests 15 ways to fix the world. That's a pretty good start, isn't it? The trouble is, those 15 ways to fix the world include the global transforming end the vice presidency and redesign the dollar. Not revalue it, but redesign it. Make it look different, because that'll make all the difference, and then the world will be all right. I'm not convinced by theatlantic.com. Of course, the answer to the question, how do we fix the world, depends on what you think the problem is, doesn't it? So elsewhere on Google, page one, we have explainingthefuture.com, catchy name. And there we're told of seven ways to fix the world, all of which centre on the environment and the harm we are causing it through our lifestyles today. It didn't surprise me to see that issue quite so far high up amongst people's concerns. And obviously, that remains a big issue that needs addressing. But I think most of us, when we ask this question, how do we fix the world, we're thinking about a bit more than just the natural world around us, just the reality of environment. We're thinking about the world in terms of the atmosphere and the feel and the experience that we have of life, and that humanity as a whole has of life. So we recognise, I think, the issue at heart is not primarily about how we treat the world, although clearly that is significant. Actually, in the end, what we're really asking is about how we treat each other. I think it's issues of suffering and poverty and abuse and neglect. Those are interpersonal, and those are the main ways, I think, which blight the world that we live in. Which brings me to another Google link, to an article in the Washington Post from December 2013, which was reviewing a new book called The Solution Revolution, which was all about dealing with the problems of the world. Let me read you its opening couple of paragraphs of this review. The cover of Wired magazine's December issue inspires me, but it also stresses me out. Guest editor Bill Gates wants you to fix the world, it proclaims. Then three ambitions: big ideas, smart innovation, bright future. Next, three commands: end poverty, save lives, cure disease. I read magazines and books to learn how other people are making the world a better place. And now it's up to me. I appreciate the vote of confidence, but that's a lot of pressure. Especially because it's no longer just about volunteering on weekends or giving to charity. You can't end poverty and cure disease in your spare time. No, unless you're constantly innovating, disrupting, problem-solving, life-teaching, starting up and spinning off, you're missing out on the solution revolution. That's the title and the ethos of a new book by management consultants William D. Egger and Paul McMillan. Well, it's obviously a challenging book, isn't it? But what I want you to notice is the candidly honest and revealing response by the reviewer. I read magazines and books to learn how other people are making the world a better place. And now it's up to me. See, this book apparently is calling for a total lifestyle change, and the reviewer is all of a sudden, honestly, reluctant and holding back. And the first concern which honestly comes to his head is, what's this going to mean for me? Or even more precisely, what is it going to cost me? So rather than enthusiasm as an opportunity to fix the world, whether the book's right or not, the first thought he has is, how will this make life harder for me? I don't think he's alone in that. I suspect that in much the same way, when we go to a price comparison website for energy, we are more drawn to the cheaper prices than to the environmentally friendly ones. Even though we recognise that concern for the environment is important. And then again, when the issue of fair trade good comes up, our first thought, I would think, is probably about price. Even though we know that paying someone a reasonable living wage isn't simply about fair reward, but about putting food on their table. Despite what we know to be important, still we pause. I think that writer's honesty reflects us all and how we think. And there, I think, we see the problem to be fixed in this world. And it's me. See, workers' rights are abused because companies want big profits. But they're also abused because I want cheap clothes and cheap food. Closer to home, I snap at my wife, not because she's done anything wrong, but because I stayed up late last night watching TV or playing a computer game, so I was tired and irritable this morning. From the smallest of things to the greatest, I put myself first. And there are consequences. You can educate me to your heart's content. You can provide for me. You can help me think through my actions. And those are all good things to do. But that doesn't stop me from doing stupid, hurtful things. It doesn't stop me putting myself first. And I don't think I'm much different from the rest of the world in that. Putting ourselves first ultimately lies behind most of the problems of this world. Self first for a little more comfort. Self first for a slightly easier life. Self first to keep me happy, because you have to look after number one. Jesus' diagnosis of the problem of humanity in Mark chapter 7 is remarkably to the point. He says this: it's not what goes into your body that defiles you, that messes you up. You are defiled by what comes out of your heart. It's not what goes in, it's what comes out. Jesus says, quite bluntly, there is something broken inside. And what's more, when he says those words, he's addressing the respectable religious leaders of his day and his own followers when he declares that humanity's problem is inside. He's not talking there about those on the edges of society, those that we sigh and shake our heads at, those we despair at for their lack of self-control. No, he's talking about humanity in general. At the time, he was looking at what seemed to be the cream of humanity. He's looking at the most together, the most upright, the most moral people of his day. And he says, we don't need a simple debugging patch to put us on the right lines. He says, we need total reprogramming. We don't just need better opportunities or more education. We need transformation. That ultimately, the world is broken because we are broken. And I think that diagnosis rings true to me when I look at the world and when I look at myself. And if we were to leave it there this evening, this would be a very depressing evening, wouldn't it? Not unrealistic, but fairly depressing. But Jesus doesn't end with a diagnosis and then walk away. Instead, Jesus offers transformation. He doesn't simply offer us an example to follow with the instruction to sort yourself out, follow me, get on with it, stop making such a mess of things. Because the truth is, I can't do that. No matter how hard I try, all my good intentions, I do good things, but not all the time. Far from it. My broken programming takes over. In the end, I think, we can't fix the world because we can't fix ourselves. But God can fix us. And that's what he offers. He offers forgiveness for those things we've done wrong. He offers transformation and a fresh start and a new beginning, a new heart. He offers to make us different if we will surrender to him. But that's where it starts. That's where it starts, admitting that we have done things wrong, admitting that we are broken, and that he is the only one who can forgive us and fix us. Well, if you want to read more about who Jesus is and what he has to say about the world, there are some copies of Mark on the table you can take, free for you to take away. Have a read and see for yourself just who Jesus is and what a great king he is to give ourselves to.